on and to have a chance to talk to Anthony Gormley, who's coming to talk at an installation today. Anthony, when and where were you born?
I was born in Hampstead, in London, in 1950.
And you were a very big family.
The seventh of seven, yeah.
Seventh of seven.
And my mum is from Germany, from Hamburg, mm. and my dad is Irish, well, Irish-English. He grew up in Warsaw.
Yes.
In the West Midlands.
Do I deduce from the Irishness the fact you went to Ambleforth and you were, there were seven of you, anything about your religious background?
Yeah, no, I grew up in a very religious family. And we regularly prayed together before going
Catholics.
Yeah, Catholics. And I can remember trooping off to church together. Very important. Oh yeah, that's mine.
Sorry.
Did I leave that on your desk?
Oh, it's just on the hallway.
Okay, I'll just close this.
So you remember trooping off to church?
Yeah, I remember trooping off to church, yeah, on a Sunday and fainting regularly I remember we got a dispensation to have orange juice with sugar in it so that we wouldn't faint. but we'd sort of leave at 7 in the morning, I guess. It must have been the earliest Mass. And then we'd come back for bacon and eggs. It was perfectly marvellous in a way. Get that all out of the way and then the rest of Sunday was sort of...
What about the effect of religion later on through your life? I mean, you remained a Catholic or...?
No, as soon as I left school, I dropped it all.
After Ambleforth?
After Ambleforth. And I think it's a very interesting thing, the total answering of questions that Catholicism provides you with. You know, why am I here? I'm here to serve God, whatever. You know, why did God make me love him and serve him, whatever. I mean, those sort of... Either there was a defined purpose or it was a mystery and we weren't supposed to know. But that kind of universal understanding of, in a way, the human condition is not a bad thing to be given as a child. And when it collapses because it is intellectually unsustainable, in a way, you spend the rest of your life trying to find something to replace it, or not replace it. But anyway, I mean, I think there is then a supposition that somehow you have to find other foundations for meaning. And I guess that explains why my motivation, you could say, and certainly having lost my faith. I think from that point onwards, I was searching. I was searching, and I was, in a way, analysing my situation. And I say that now from a vantage point of, you know, 40 years down the road, or more, 48 years down the road. And I can remember coming here. It was coming to Cambridge was a kind of an opening of a door. That there were other traditions, that there were other ways of thinking about the world, that there were profoundly different genealogies of culture. And it was fantastic coming here and doing anthropology and then later art history.
You did the first year Arcanas.
First year Arcanas. And after, in that first long vacation, I went to India for the first time. And it was the combination, I think, of learning about in a intellectual way, whether it was reading Marcel Mauss or reading Levi-Strauss or whatever, about alternative cultures, and then going and experiencing them firsthand. And certainly, you know, both the long vacations, I travelled east, essentially, and second time I went to Syria, southern Turkey, Lebanon, visiting ancient sites and more recent ones, Tyre, Sidon, Hama, Homs, Alanya, Antakya, Mersin, Side, Ephesus, and that extraordinary coast of the south of Turkey, places like Pamukkale, where Gorome, where there was a wonderful dialogue, I think, between indigenous cultures and the classical world. Anyway, I think for me, the losing of the Catholic faith and the beginning of looking at the world as a open book full of possibility, it happened at the same time.
You studied Buddhism at one point, didn't you?
Well, after leaving Cambridge, I went to India, and that was a really important... I mean, it took me a year to get there. I spent a long time. I spent a long time, again, back in Syria. I loved Syria, and particularly Aleppo and Damascus. Spent a lot of time with artists there. And then in Baghdad, and then north of Baghdad, I was arrested finally by the border guards on my way to see Mullah Mustafa Barzani, the leader of the Peshmerga, the Kurdish resistance, and spent a rather uncomfortable 10 days in the hands of the police being interrogated, ending up in the high security prison in Baghdad, which was a very unpleasant experience altogether. But then, then on into Iran, crossing from Basra into southern Iran and Kermanshah, and then visiting Shiraz and Isfahan, Bandar Abbas, and then up to Mashhad. But all of that took about 5 months, and then I kind of got stuck in Afghanistan for another 5 months because the Indian-Pakistan war was on. But that was a wonderful thing too, having gone from the great madrasas of southern Persia to Mashhad, and then on to Herat, and spending some time there, both in the mountains and looking at those really wonderful 16th century madrasas and minarets in the outskirts of Herat, and then south into Kandahar and Helmand province, looking at there's a wonderful ruin where Alexander the Great kept his elephants south of Kandahar, which is now kind of vast, melting, mud brick citadel. And then in the spring, across the Salang Pass and up into Mazar-i-Sharif and Kunduz, and then I crossed the steppes as far as the border on the road to Samarkand, but didn't cross it. But anyway, I had a lot of adventures on the way to India, and then India itself, spent a week in the Golden Temple in Amritsar, met some Tibetans there who were Kardyut Tibetans, and they invited me to Dalhousie, and I went to Dalhousie, which was an old British hill station, and took a house, a strange sort of half-tumble-down mock Tudor house on the side of the foothills of the Himalayas, and at the same time heard about a Buddhist meditation course that was being taught by S.N. Goenka, who was a Burmese national who'd come to India. I'd heard that he was a great meditation teacher, and I signed up. And that was the beginning of my involvement with Vipassana. And I think that was another well, maybe the most important thing that happened to me in my life, really, having had a relatively classical education, having learnt from books and objects, material culture, from painting, sculpture, the ceramic record, suddenly being given a technique by which one can develop mindfulness and be aware of being itself as a subject of attention. I think a remarkable tool, a remarkable gift, and I ended up doing 10-day courses over the next 2 years with Goenka and staying in a variety of vihars and monasteries. I was attached to a monastery in Sanada, which was Kargyud, took teachings from Kala Rinpoche, the Rinpoche abbot of the monastery. But essentially my practice is Hinayana, really basic development of samadhi through anapana, awareness of breath, and then vipassana, which is really a concentration on being through a very close attention to the body as a space of exploration, which through, I think, persistent mindfulness becomes not a limiting space, but an open, porous space. And I think that realization, and with it, I think, the philosophy of Buddhism, which is not really a religion, it's certainly not about worship or devotion or any notion of Godhead. It's really about trying to deal with the mind-body problem in the most direct way possible, which is to say, I am consciousness in a material world. What constitutes this relationship between mind and matter? This constant, in a way, dialogue between the ability of thought to arise mind moment by mind moment in a physical universe that is bounded by processes, by flows, by energy transfer, and the idea that you can make a conscious effort to use your body both as a space station but also as a form of laboratory, a place of experimentation and analysis. And through that process to, I think, peel away the things that through ignorance attach you to the idea that you possess anything that we, for convenience sake, call this my body, but of course it's not ours. It's on temporary loan from systems that we barely understand of material exchange, carbon life forms that have been built up over millions of years. And it's a strange thing, because within all of us we have the capability of, through language and through, in a way, the symbolic ordering of experience, to convey it. But in fact, through Buddhism, I was introduced to another way that was maybe less to do with articulation and less to do with the translation of experience into forms of symbolic exchange. And a door was opened whereby, I guess, all of those forms of attachment that are so central to the philosophy of Buddhism that we somehow managed to release ourselves from, was given to me. And I think the development of my sculpture is an attempt say that all of the work comes out of vipassana, comes out of mindfulness of a moment of being. This is a real body in real time that is captured in space. It's not a representation. It's not a perfect copy. It's an index. And I think it's important to distinguish. Peirce's categories are very useful for this, between a symbol, an image, and an index. I'm not interested in symbolic language. I'm not interested in the perfect copy, as in a virtuous oil painting, you say, this statue of a Greek philosopher. I'm interested in the index because it has to do with evidence. It has to do with, in a way, touching reality. Indices happen naturally. The shadow is an index. The imprint of your thumb on a window pane is an index. In a sense, I tried to use that idea of an actual impression of a moment of being as the basis, the foundation of my work. So most of my work is a moment of, if you like, intense concentration on being, which is then captured by a process of moulding. And I think that idea of a foundation in fact that has no expressionist ambition, but is simply about saying, this is a moment where somebody was, and the invitation and implication of that is, through empathy, where anybody could be. And if we transfer our expectations in terms of what a statue is from the idea that this is a symbolic or idealized memorial of a particular person, and think of this as simply a displacement of space that happens to have human characteristics. So this is the body not as an object, but as a place. Then this form that I use in my work suddenly becomes perhaps more open. And that idea of the abstract body, which is perhaps because of our dialectical thinking and because of the development of Western art, we have this absolute division between, on the one hand, figurative, and on the other, abstract forms of expression. I think that there is something called the abstract body. Anyway, that's what I'm trying to make. And in some senses, that's been the lost subject in Western iconography. And this is something that Gombrich talks about extremely well in the history of art, in the story of art that he wrote, that in some way the process of Western art has been about successive models in which visual perception can be conveyed and carried. And the idea of a kind of narrative, a narrative purpose in art that either celebrates religious truths, political, historical truths, the idea of making, in a way, a believable representation of the way things look. And that went through right through to Impressionism. In a curious way, you could say that with the arrival of photography, certainly, you know, that whole trajectory is seen as it's a very partial and very particular story, and it's certainly not the only story. And when you look at other traditions and you see the persistence of the need to make an equivalent to the human body, but within abstract body occurs the whole time, whether that's in oceanic art, in pre-classical Mediterranean art, if you look at Cycladic work. But it happens most potently, I think, in the art of Asia. If you see the development from early Gupta through Mathurin, through Kola, Pala, and then on to the great schools of Khmer sculpture, you find what I'm talking about. This is not about the body in action, it's not about a frozen moment in a narrative story from mythology or from real history. This is about body as a site of being, not an actor in some kind of narrative drama. It's not the body illustrating an action. It's about making the space of an image into some kind of a focus for life. There's an understanding about the limitations of what sculpture is, that it is silent, that it is still, that it exists in time in a different register to biological time, and that in some sense it's through the stillness and silence of sculpture we as moving, living, feeling, conscious beings can sense our own being in time and space through the agency of the work. And that idea about agency, the idea that art is not simply about the virtuous representation of privileged or powerful people, but actually that the space of art can be used for everybody, every living being with consciousness to sense their own lives in a different register. It has become very, very important to me. So I think in the development of my work, that reference to an alternative tradition that has recognized the subject that was lost, really, after modernism. We can see it in the loss of, in a sense, the craftsmanship of the academic tradition of dealing with the figure. But we lost, there's a sense in which modernism denied the body. And from the point, you could say from Cubism onwards, what happened in the 20th century was that art became increasingly concerned with its inner formal syntax and became more and more separated from life and became more and more institutionalized. You should say it's a very curious thing culturally that for most of us, when we think about art, we think about the museum. That would not have been true 100 years ago. The institutionalization of art is one of the tragedies, I think, about our time. We need to reintegrate the space of art into our lives, that dimension, in a way, whether it's reverie or dream, or simply the idea of an alternative space through which the world of work can be countered by something else. So, for me, looking at pre-literate societies, or anyway, examples within human history where the idea of the artist has not become another specialist who has become separated with his or her own, as it were, professional concerns that are, as it were, separated and to re-examine through maybe an anthropological model, looking, you know, what is it that people find necessary to do? What are the stories that people tell, the dances they dance, the clothes that they make, the spaces that they make together? And is there another more integrative model in which art comes in again I guess, you know, for me now, I mean, the two most important projects that are, one's just happened and one's in the process of happening, Clay and the Collective Body, which was a real attempt to engage, well, just everybody in the idea that they are makers of the future. I'll describe the project because it's very simple. 100 tons of clay, that's a cube, 4 meters by 4 meters by 2 meters 60, placed inside a pneumatic translucent building that is 36 meters by 36 meters by 15 meters high. We exposed the cube for 4 days and then allowed 60 people at a time, with the commitment that they were going to spend 4 hours, unbroken hours, in relation to this material. The atmosphere was 95 degrees humidity, 23 degrees of heat. The outside atmosphere was 0 degrees humidity, minus 15. In this environment, in which there was only this earth material, the bodies of the participants and the space, they were not allowed tools, was this primal engagement with, if you like, this material, which in some senses is a ur material, a base material, which invited touch. It was a regressive environment because there were no windows, you couldn't see the outside. There was an airlock door. Once you passed through that door, you were committed to what was happening within. We were not allowed cameras or mobile phones. And it was very interesting. People said to me afterwards, I hadn't done that since being a child. I hadn't been sitting on the floor. I was frightened of using my hands. I had never been given that opportunity. And what happened was that this, in a way, arising of culture, that people maybe were making for the first time, translating in a way thought and feeling into touch and making objects. The rules were very simple. If you could work anywhere, you could work directly on the cube, you could take clay from the cube and start an alternative world somewhere else. And what arose was this non-verbal communication, in which often we were led by the children. The youngest child was six, who came. They had no problem. I don't know what happens to human beings if you give a six-year-old a piece of paper and a pencil. They will just start drawing naturally. Give them a lump of clay and they'll make something naturally. Something happens between the age of six and the age of 12 when people say, oh, I can't draw. Or, no, I won't. Anyway, those children led us in terms of doing. And from the fear of the white page or the empty space that the first people came coming into the hall was very swiftly transmuted into a delight arriving in the hall and seeing evidence of what others had done. And interestingly, some people who were nervous simply continued the work that somebody else had left. But what happened with this project called Clay and the Collective Bodies? By the end of it, 1,500 people or thereabouts had worked together, often completing and extending things that had been left by others. And this enormous landscape, the cube was almost completely gone, and the entire space was filled with thousands and thousands of objects of all scales and all kinds, from very, very complex models of landscapes with villages and seas and graveyards and olive groves, to disembodied body parts. There was, on day three, suddenly there were penises everywhere, laid kind of on the floor. And then on day five, suddenly skulls arrived and there was an outbreak of cranial presences that sort of were on the floor, or menagerie of biological forms, some of which were fantasies, some of which were very well observed, wonderful architectural structures. But what was extraordinary was how dialogues would happen. A woman over here would be intent on making a forest, and she'd make 300 trees that were roughly this size. And then she'd see over there somebody had made a kind of grid of hand-sized balls just rolled in the hand, and she went over and deposited one of her trees and took one of the balls and put the ball in her forest. And this kind of exchange between zones, it was very clear that there were neighborhoods of connectivity. There were areas where people seemed to love making long spaghetti, which would then they would make either coil up into structures or use as a form of drawing. And that sort of evolved, like rhizome-like, through this evolving landscape. There were very ambitious igloos where people constructed entire internal worlds that were sometimes a bit like the inside of a mouth, sometimes literally like a cave with primal scenes. What was beautiful was there was no criteria here. It was a self-regulating process in which people might be worried, where is the art? Where? Well, maybe that's the question. Where is the art? Maybe it doesn't matter. What it was simply an open space in which those dialectics of producer and consumer, or the viewer and the viewed, were collapsed. And that people, you could say the first thing they noticed was a space, this extraordinary, huge, luminous space. The second thing they noticed was, in a sense, the smell, the humidity, the warmth, and then this myriad of forms that looked like a coral reef by the end. And it was as if they were absorbing and then contributing to maybe something that had already existed. And that was the extraordinary thing, that actually the strangeness of this adults being invited to play, adults being invited in some way to be in a way that they hadn't been. Well, maybe when they were last on the beach and played with the sand, they had been. But they were allowed to be in a different way. And there was a lovely, I mean, it was as if this sharing of a common ground, sharing of a common material, suddenly released people from expectations or the kind of identities that they had held themselves within previously. Anyway, for me, Play of a Neglected Body was an inspirational, literally an inspirational event. There was no product, it was simply that the beauty of the process. What people gained from the experience and from each other through being there, through this, in a way, commitment of time. The work was simply swept up and sent to a garden centre. The brick factory that gave the clay in the first place didn't want it back. They, for whatever reason, thought that it would be impossible to turn back into bricks, which I rather liked. So it then went to a garden centre to be mixed with peat and become the equivalent of compost for the garden. So where does this work exist? I think it exists in memory now. We have some photographic evidence. But I like the idea that this is simply thinking of art as a space of potential, where the viewer in some sense is also the viewed, where the some sense is this, the possibility of transformation, the possibility of another form of communicating that is not to do with symbolic language in the way that it has become broadcastable and transmissible now. Anyway, that was one example of an attempt to reintegrate, in a way, art as a way of being within daily life. And the other is my fourth plinth project for London, which is opening on the 6th of July, in which I'm inviting people to occupy the fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square, a plinth made in the middle of the 19th century for William IV, the son of George IV. But nobody liked him enough to actually make the equestrian statue, and it's remained empty ever since. And I'm simply inviting the inhabitants of the UK to occupy it one person at a time, 1 hour at a time, 24 hours a day, night and day, for 100 days. And it's a very simple idea. To use the frame, the space of idealization of art, as an exercise in representation, and saying, because of our civic history, certain people have been chosen as, in a way, representatives of collective memory. And certainly in Trafalgar Square, they are all military, naval and military, or regal. George Washington came in late, but on the whole they all have to do with British history. Napier, Havelock, Nelson, etc. And it proposes that every citizen is in some senses the repository of collective memory. And the question that the project asks is, what happens when you get, as it were, real life to occupy the space of, in a way, the idealized statue? You can say, well, you get something very akin to a performance space. You get something very akin to, in a way, Speaker's Corner. I like that aspect of the project, but in some senses this is celebrated. Continuing a long tradition in these islands of freedom of speech, of the right of self-expression. But I think you also get something else, which is from the other side of the spectacle. What does it mean for the subject, for the person experiencing this hour, to be that isolated? And that alone, and that removed from common ground for that length of time, an hour is quite a long time. What do they learn about themselves? The project is called One and Other. And it is an inquiry into, in a way, representation, as much as it is a democratization of this, in a way, the notion of the plinth and everything it proposes, which is that this is a special person. This is a unique example of what human beings can achieve. And I think when a housewife from Pinner stands up there clutching her Tesco bag, just the very fact of standing at a statue we often take for granted. When you're 8 meters from the ground, unprotected, it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and it's raining. That act of standing becomes a very different thing. What somebody might learn from that experience is, I think, for me, the heart of the project. And also, I think, will constitute perhaps the most valuable part of the record. We will make an archive. The archive will be something. But I think of this work, One Another, as being an opportunity to take the temperature of, in a way, the UK now. And maybe we will learn something about ourselves. Maybe we will learn about what we fear, what we hope, what we find funny, what we care about, what we enjoy doing as well. I hope that there will be. You know, there's a wealth of talent out there. I'm sure that there will be extraordinary acts of juggling or monocycling or BMXing. But I hope that there will also be this register of the diversity of Britain now, where I focus on the individual.
And about friends.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult thing. I banned mobile phones from play in the collective body because, in a way, that was a uterine space, and it was very important, I think, to leave the real world behind. But with One Another, in some senses, I think we are recognizing the condition of, in a way, post-modernity, that actually we are all connected, and that. Certainly, you know, there are going to be 5 fixed cameras where everybody will be, well, recorded in the manner of the CCTV, but even more extremely. Yeah. And I think that probably people will want to use their mobile phones to take, you know, this unique kind of account of the world around them when they're up there, and send it to their YouTube friends, or and I think that's kind of okay.
When you said that, in a way, you were working out the effects of the loss of your formal through your sculpture, one thing that puzzled me watching a film of you in your studio was that you, I think, describe yourself as a conductor with this huge team of people. And you said, I was a conductor, but I also wrote the score, which is not normally what conductors do. And I can see how that gives you more of an input into it. But I would have thought the danger is that you lose touch with the product or the thing you're making. I mean, as a craftsman, the delegation and the separation of activities could easily lead to you ending up as just...
a manager.
Yes.
Yeah, I think this is a good question. The interesting thing about sculpture, so far as I'm concerned, is that it is always a shared job. I mean, whether it's Epstein getting somebody to do the roughing out on Adam or whatever. I mean, his large alabaster. Or Michelangelo being the same for that matter. I think the fact is that sculpture of all the arts, the studios of Rubens and Van Dyck and the brothers Bruegel, equally involved a lot of people working together in a very collegiate manner. And I think for me, the studio now has become, in a sense, a human instrument, and it's keeping everyone fully focused on what they're doing, and allowing, in a sense, the work to arise. I think that the idea that somehow one is ever in control is false. I mean, it's a false illusion. I think the arising of an object has to do with, yes, the exercising of will, yes, the idea that you have a very good plan. But I think what makes things interesting and what gives them energy is the fact that you're responding the whole time to the think that's about the acute balance between discipline and desire. And it's something that can, yes, it can exist within me as an artist, but I think it can also exist in others. And I think that one of the, certainly for me, the joy as well as the challenge now of being a late middle-aged artist is that I've gathered around me a group of people who I trust implicitly. They've become, in a sense, my family, and with whom I can hardly think of living without. I mean, I need them. They are my extended mind and body. And there are very simple and basic rules at the studio. If you can think or feel that something can be done better and you don't do it, you betray the work yourself and in a way the calling of art, which is, I think, always to go further if you can. And there are, I think of this as an unfolding. The language that we are evolving is allowing us to maybe express things or maybe to touch things that were not touchable before. There's a level of research as well as a level of, if you like, production. I think the two are always in tension. We never want to simply just make something for the sake of making it. We want to make something that is the result of something that's already, or the next step on from something that's already made. So the work is itself the greatest master. I used to think that I made the work. I think that now that the work is making us.
So the work is Buddhist thought.
It's very demanding. Mm-hmm. And I can't actually fulfill all the requirements and imperatives that the work is imposing on us. I can't. It's absolutely extraordinary the imperatives. If you believe in a sense, paying attention to what this evolving world is that is happening as you make, and if the making is a dimension of thinking, then the implications are rhizomic. And I need my friends. I need my friends. Anyway, so the issue for me, we are not running a production shop. We are running a research institute, or it's somewhere between a kindergarten, a research institute, a kitchen, and an institution for the mentally disturbed, you could say. I mean, you know, it's a mixture of a lot of different things. But all I have to say is that I am just delighted and privileged to work in the way that I do, and this is my work has become a collective enterprise or a collective sort of adventure. It's an exploration, and like any other exploration, and no doubt you've done them. All those different sensibilities, the way the person that has geological knowledge and can understand in a way what lies behind the topography of a landscape. You need somebody who's brilliant at the rising. And I just think, you know, sometimes I think that the greatest thing is actually just the studio and what we do together. It's an open-ended research endeavor that uses physical thinking as its form. And you know, I wouldn't have it any other way. Now, I think that the notion, which I think is quite counter productive to true creativity, that there is, as it were, a unique individual genius who only through his magic and shamanic touch can transform dross into something of value. I mean, I want everyone that works with me to fly. I want them to feel identified in the work. It's not they're making the work for somebody else. They're making the work for the work. And the work has absolute demands. And the work is about the interface between the knowable and the ineffable, the unknowable, the inconceivable, the kind of... And we're always testing the skin or the edge or trying to, in a way, make it porous between what is conceivable and what is palpable, or you know, what might be imagined and what might be realized. And it's a the idea that it's a lonely adventure is a romantic fiction. I think the fact is you have to be extremely well planned. You have to be extremely well prepared. You have to plan ahead. You have to do all the same things that you would do in any other responsible project. And I feel that I'm more in contact. But the work isn't mine. I don't think it ever was, any more than my body is mine. It's not, you know, and that's, yeah. People will continue to accuse me of narcissism or whatever, and they may well be right. But anyway, the issue for me is just deal with what is arising and do it in the best way or the most effective way possible. And for me at the moment, working with a team of 20 or so, seems pretty effective. I'm sure there's always improvement. I'm sure you better come and have a look.
'm going to say a few words and introduce Colin Renfrew, my predecessor, who also created the Institute and who also set up this linkage that's ended up with this wonderful day with Anthony Gormley here to inaugurate Plant. It's very fitting. Anthony read Archaeology and Anthropology, Part 1, a few years after I did, and he then went on to do History of Art at Trinity. Of course, he's gone on to completely revolutionise, transform our appreciation of the human body. Art has been hugely influential for all of us, and particularly through using his own body, and for us, for archaeology. In fact, it's been very, very influential. The way he's made us think about cultural landscapes created by people, has actually had a strong influence there. And of course, in terms of his thinking about the body, that has also been hugely timely. And in fact, really by chance, we've been having a significant research project here run by John Robin, involving many colleagues in the faculty, in archaeology and in anthropology in the museum, working on how the body is, how we think about it, how it's presented, how it's been transformed through the ages. And in fact, there's an exhibition that was the culmination of this project in the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology at the moment, So an awful lot of things chime together really well. This idea that I gather goes back to Colin and Anthony 15 or so years ago has finally come to fruition. And of course for archaeology, it's very attractive because it's a buried body, it's an excavation. Those of us who are here, I should say at the end of this inauguration, we'll have wine in the McDonald's. And in the McDonald's also are displays of the happy occasion when many of us were here, when the body came and the body went in. And we watched the excavation beforehand with the Dewley Archaeological Eye. In fact, one of the archaeologists here at Cambridge had to check it out to make sure there was no significant other archaeology as well. And so most of us are driven by this curiosity about the past. We don't live in the past, but we're curious about it. And of course, excavation is at the heart of what we do. We do many other things, but excavation, that whole business still of touching the past, being the first person to touch the past, is an extraordinary feeling that has got all of us into this subject. But in this case, we've got something very unusual, which of course we know, those of us who are here, what's in the ground, or perhaps we think we know, which is a very unusual thing for us as archaeologists. It was an extraordinary occasion. It was very much, I suppose, like, I think about it, like the people who must put mummies in pyramids, because this extraordinary body came in a coffin that's over there. You'll see the photographs in it. It came up entirely wrapped like a mummy, but in cling film. The cling film was removed, and it was taken down into there. Anyway, so for all these reasons, I think, so the part that Anthony's played in archaeology and tying us all together, it has been it's a lovely idea that's come to fruition and is, I think, very meaningful for all of us. Anthony will talk about the piece, but I think that we should be there. The idea is that we stand on it, we imagine it's ourselves up here, it's the body down below, and we think about, as what archaeology is about, you know, who we are, where we've come from, where we're going. That's what's at the heart of the subject. It's a very emblematic piece, I think, for many of us. I should say, finally, in terms of the thanks that have made this possible, James Barrett, the deputy director, one of the first things when he came, I said, here you are, it wasn't something that he was expecting. So James played an important role.
Where's James?
I'm back. The key person who can't be here today has done a huge amount is Liz Farmer, James' secretary. Liz has been absolutely fabulous through it all, and unfortunately her mother's very ill today, so she couldn't come today of all days, but she's played a huge role. Edwina Murray, the Royal Academy Registrar, played a big role with Liz, making it happen. EMBS, the University State Service, were terrific too. Mark Viennes and Colin Hines. I don't know if Colin's here, is he? Fine? No. So they've been very important as part of the installation. The MTEC firm that Anthony used, and Anthony's organised all of this at his own expense for this to happen. And I think the final key person, obviously, we have to thank is Colin Renfrew. Our lives have all been enhanced by what Colin's written, what Colin's done. Many of us have had our lives personally touched by him. We're standing in a thing that is such a result of his extraordinary abilities here, the McDonald. He's also played a huge role in bringing art and archaeology together. He is our very own precious installation, and I'm going to hand over to him, and we're hoping at the end, once it's open, that Colin should be the first person to install himself here. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Graham. It's indeed a great day. It's a great day for the Faculty of Archaeology and Anthropology, and it's certainly a great day for the McDonald Institute, and it's a day we've been looking forward to for some considerable time. We're very fortunate, I think, that Anthony conceived not only this work, but also that the opportunity has arisen. It's arisen through the generosity of the Royal Academy, and Edwina is here, and we're very grateful for the Royal Academy, which has, through Anthony's generosity also, extended this work as a long-term loan to the faculty and to the McDonald Institute. And if the members officials of the Estate Management and Building Service are here, they will certainly wish it, as we do, to be a very long-term loan indeed, because it wasn't an easy work to install, and we're grateful also to MTEC for doing so. But Anthony's work really is, as Graham has said, of compelling interest for an archaeologist. It's about coming into the world, it's about being in the world, it's about learning to be in the world, and it confronts the material reality of that existence. And at Jesus College, we're very fortunate to have his work Learning to See in our library. And now here we have Plant, which has the longer title, Earthbound Plant. It's a challenging work. It's about vision, of course, but it's also about thought and knowledge, because it's a work where you have to know as well as to see. And those of us who were here a few weeks ago are lucky, because we know more than most of the rest of you, because we actually saw it go into the ground. And so we're definitely in a third party position. There is the artist, there is the viewer, but there are those of us who also know more than you do. And that's a very happy position to be in. So it's about knowledge, and it's about memory, perhaps collective memory, and it's about belief. It's about credence. Do you believe what I'm saying? Well, that's up to you. What does it mean? Is it really there? Where does it come from? It's a very interrogative work. In a sense, most, perhaps all of Anthony's works are interrogative works, but this is a very interrogative work indeed. And for archaeologists who have a special relationship with the earth, with the ground, it is particularly appropriate. Archaeology from the Earth was Sir Morton Wheeler's great work, great book anyway, and so that's a dimension. Anthony has written, this work has a vertical axis to do with light and darkness, with the sky and earth, of the road that goes between here and there, somewhere and nowhere, a kind of compass, a lodestone where people can stand for a moment and think about where they fit in this world. And that's a very appropriate thing to have in a university quadrangle where people are coming and going and need indeed to think about where they fit in this world, as perhaps do the teachers who attempt to teach them. As I said, it's here in Cambridge because of the Royal Academy's generous loan scheme, and we do thank the Royal Academy, and I'd also like to thank Liz Farmer. We regret that she can't be here today. But above all, it's here in Cambridge and beside the Haddon Library because Anthony wished it to be so. We're very grateful for that, Anthony, and we're grateful above all for your wonderful work, of which this is such an intriguing instance, that confronts us with what it is to be in the world as material and sentient beings. As archaeologists, or indeed as anthropologists, we are asking much the same questions, and we are deeply grateful for your illumination of them in all its challenging materiality. So thank you very much.
Golly. It's really wonderful, isn't it? The sun's shining, we're here, witnessing each other, and then there's this other poor chap who's going somewhere else. What can I say? This is about friendship, this is about continuity. I never knew, really, when I came here to study anthropology and archaeology, that I'd end up being a sculptor. But it's in sculpture that, in some way, I've carried on my research. And it is, as both Derek and Colin have so eloquently said, very much to do with what are the links between what you can think, what is conceivable, what is perceivable, what you can see, and what is palpable, what you can touch. In a sense, those are philosophical questions, but I think of sculpture as a form of, in a way, physical thinking. This is reverse archaeology. I've done reverse anthropology as well. I mean, I've made kind of things with native peoples that I've put, with their permission, in their own landscape, rather than, as it were, going and studying them and then coming back with my field notes and writing a book for, as it were, the literate amongst us. And I think of this as a form of reverse archaeology. As Colin has said, there were those who witnessed the interment of the sculpture. They, in some senses, now are the living kind of eyewitnesses to that history. But in some senses, what I want this to be is also an engagement with life as it's lived. It was very important to me that it is on the kind of the crossroads here. People bicycling or walking will consciously or unconsciously step over these feet. It's a invitation to stop, but you don't have to stop. In a sense, how does our environment change by having, in a way, a dimension that is both physical but also imaginative? The thing is that you, all of you, or anybody who passes, can think about the space of the body that lies beneath the surface of things, beneath the palpable and the perceivable. Well, we have a connection here. There's a kind of, you know, like the two points on the end of a battery. We've got these two points that you can, if you so choose, connect with. And I think what I'm interested in is memory and how, in a sense, we are all, each of us citizens, we are repositories of collective memory, but we also can, in a way, make memory for others. And that idea of participation, that in some senses us standing here in the light are the viewed for others, that we are all participating as, in some senses, creators of a future, whether we're there to see it or not. Perhaps it's some of those thoughts that are behind this really miraculous occasion, because I never ever imagined that a work that I gave to the Royal Academy would end up in the place where it has perhaps the most relevance. And that's a real blessing. Anyway, I wanted to give Colin this. I'm going to give him this. This is a drawing of how I thought about this before I made it, sometime in the 70s. And it's just a rather remarkable thing that you can have thoughts and not do anything about them for a very long time, and then suddenly you do them. And then something else happens, and they end up, the result of this thought ends up somewhere where actually it can produce other thoughts for other people. Anyway, for me this is a wonderful, wonderful occasion. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Colin. Thank you, Derek, for allowing this work to be here and have a continued life. And I'm just very happy to have been here as a student and now to, in some way, be disembodiedly a continual presence or a continual learning opportunity for the future. Thank you very much, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, hey presto.